Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org for any with any feedback, story suggestions, ideas, whatever the case may be. Later this hour, the world may be one step closer to the ultimate sustainable energy. We've made a step forward in nuclear fusion. And we will have Dr. Wolfgang Bauer, MSU physics professor, explain the importance of that. And we also learn on Wednesday, it's Neighbors in Action Day, we learn about the great work done at Haven House, East Lansing. All of that to come and more today on Current State. After weeks of pointed criticism, the Snyder administration announced on Monday that it would shut down its so-called NERD Fund. Now, as a 501c4, the New Energy to Reinvent and Diversify Fund was not legally obligated to disclose its donors, and administrators of the NERD Fund say they were in full compliance with existing laws. Unlimited and anonymous contributions to administration projects were aimed at defraying the costs of government. Instead, it raised controversy when it was learned money was used to pay for such things as travel and housing for Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr. Critics say it's impossible to know how anonymous contributors may be benefiting from the arrangement. Here with more on the NERD Fund and what may lay ahead, Rick Pluta, the Michigan Public Radio Network. Welcome back, Rick.
Hi, Mark.
Snyder spokesperson Sarah Werfel said on Monday that the donors to the NERD Fund were assured their identities would not be disclosed, but critics were still clamoring yesterday.
The governor said that directly, too. We talked to him on Monday.
Oh, okay.
I did, at least.
Are you expecting that not to happen then at this point, or is there a chance that it would?
I suppose that there is a very, very slight chance that pressure could build to the point that at least some of the donors would be revealed. But quite frankly, that's really, really, really unlikely. That the governor's been pretty adamant that the understanding when they collected donations for the NERD Fund was that the donors would not be revealed. My understanding is that some were approached and asked and were just said, no, we'd rather not. And so that going forward, under whatever this new fund is, that donors will have to agree that their names will be made public. But the donors to the NERD Fund will remain anonymous.
So in the meantime, critics assume the worst. Defenders insist it was squeaky clean.
Well, it's a great arrangement.
Nobody really knows.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a great arrangement for everyone because they can just claim whatever they want and there's nothing to refute it. So, you know, we don't know if the NERD Fund was ever used to finance drone attacks, but...
The point was allegedly to save Michigan taxpayers money by picking up some of the costs of reinventing the state.
In some respects, you know, this 501c4 and Governor Snyder is not the only one who has one, seems to have sort of picked up the role of the old office holder expense fund. That's a golden oldie. That it used to be that in Michigan, elected officials would have what was called an OEF, and they would use it to defray costs incidental to holding office. And sometimes it was used for everything from, you know, buying pins and flags and stuff to hand out at parades and to constituents, to buying tickets to games and sometimes even car leases. Eventually, OEFs were scrapped just because the optics had become so bad that they just seemed kind of sleazy. And so now, but you know, I mean, none of these things ever go away. They never disappear entirely. Someone pointed out this morning that, you know, go back to Richard Nixon and, you know, remember the troubles that he had, and it was because of a fund that was paid for by, you know, fat cats to, you know, pick up particular costs. And now it seems like the 501c4 is just the latest incarnation
it
of that.
Morphs into something slightly
different. The 501c4, as it is used by politicians, seems to have kind of morphed into that.
How does the IRS classify a 501c4?
501c4s are the classic charity is a 501c3, and those are ones where, like, if you donate to it, then you get to take the tax deduction. And so that's sort of the classic charity. And then right after that in the tax code is the 501c4, which is a social welfare organization that's devoted to a charitable, educational, or recreational purpose, dedicated to promoting the common good and general welfare of whatever community is you're trying to promote the common good
and general welfare. And politics has crept into this.
Well, it's what happened was smart attorneys found that they could use this 501c4 to basically, do what you used to do with the office holder expense fund, which was use it for, things that are incidental to the cost of holding office. The only thing is where the controversy came in, is, as you pointed out in your opening, is you don't know who's paying and you don't know what they expect in return. And it is axiomatic of donating to politicians that donors don't just do it out of the goodness of their heart, that there's an expectation of some sort. And so there was the suggestion, the revelation that the Nerd Fund was being used to pay the living expenses of Kevin Orr in Detroit was the result of a Freedom of Information Act request on another issue related to schools. And so, all of a sudden that raised the possibility, when are creditors donating to the Nerd Fund, with the expectation that that someone will know that when they're sitting down and negotiating on the bankruptcy that, you're sweet at the book Cadillac, I'm helping foot the cost of that. It's and again, no one can absolutely point to anything because no one knows that there's no transparency.
We also want to point out that Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer acknowledged yesterday having a 501c4 in the past. Does this practice cross party lines?
It crosses all kinds of lines. That there are 501c4s all over Lansing. That I believe all of the political caucuses in the legislature have their own 501c4s. A lot of legislators have their own 501c4s that are used for various purposes, and no, the Nerd Fund is far from unique.
Now, does that mean, just talking politics here for a second, does that mean that Mark Schauer may not get the political mileage out of this in the campaign that he otherwise would?
Well, I think that right now every politician who has a 501c4 had better be looking at it very carefully, because once it becomes an issue for one candidate, it becomes an issue for all of them potentially. As a matter of fact, Mark Schauer sort of stepped in it because his campaign was making an issue of the Nerd Fund, and he did a less than exceptional job of hanging on to the records for his 501c4, and so
he says they're all gone.
Now that's hanging out there.
What are GOP legislators at the Capitol saying about this, with regard to the governor's fund specifically?
They're not particularly concerned with it, and it sounds like it was perfectly acceptable use of funds. And again, some of them would have to be careful because they would have their own.
I got to wondering whether there's a snowball's chance that a Nerd Fund contributor may self-identify in an effort to support the governor. Is that within the realm of possibility?
It is within the realm of possibility, and theoretically that could also raise the possibility that then there would be pressure on other donors to reveal themselves. But I don't think a whole lot that someone might say, I donated to the fund. But, part of it is, pressure only works when you know where, the pressure is being applied. And if you're an anonymous donor, anonymity by its nature is anonymous.
And powerful sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The administration took heat for the Skunk Works Education Group. Now this, it seems safe to say the Snyder administration is learning some lessons the hard way.
And every administration has its share of mistakes and trip-ups along the way. And it's kind of interesting, especially when, people come from the private sector and say that, we're going to apply the things that we know work in the private sector to, you know, fix this broken system of government. And then they learn that, you know, the public sector is actually a much different environment than the private sector. And, you know, all that ridiculousness, all that seeming ridiculousness actually occurs for a reason.
The Nerd Fund raised over $1 million in 2011.
I think about $1.5 million.
Yeah, quite a bit less last year, like $1 million less last year, as I recall. Is anyone apt to disclose how much it raised in 2013, or will we just have to wait on the IRS to learn?
I would imagine that when they close it out, that there will be a pretty thorough accounting, if for no other reason than just to try and you know, put this episode behind them and close the door on it. I mean, remember, next year is an election year. You know, another question too is there's going to be a new fund created. We don't know what the name or acronym for that will be.
Do we know the IRS designation for that?
I think it'll be another 501c4. It's just that they'll make the information public because the donors will be told
that's a condition.
That's one of the conditions. Okay. And also, supposedly, there's going to be a website that lays out what the expenditures are, but they're going to do it by category. So we'll see how detailed those categories are and whether or not they really whether or not they provide meaningful information. But the other thing, too, is remember, you know, the governor is a CPA. I mean, you know, he moves around money for fun. you've got to wonder, you know, what is the new financial mechanism going to be that is used for expenditures that, you don't want made public.
Yeah, very interesting. And Richard Baird is still on the payroll?
Richard Baird, he is an old friend and mentor of the governor's who for the past 3 years or so has been paid out of the Nerd Fund for the administration position of transformation manager. Mm. And he has now been moved to the public payroll. The administration's explanation was that it was always the plan, but an arrangement with a prior employer, a legal arrangement with a prior employer, prevented him from seeking work. I mean, what that distinction is, I don't know, since, you know, you're being paid, whether it's out of the Nerd Fund or, you know, by the state, you know, as an employer.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Great context. Rick Plute of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thank you, Rick. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. And being Wednesday, it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week we feature Haven House, an East Lansing-based agency that provides emergency housing and support services for families with children. Here to tell us more about their work is Haven House Executive Director Angie Mayu. Hi, Angie.
Hi,
and
thank you.
Former client Linda Bennett. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Well, welcome to both of you to Current State. Angie, tell us about Haven House. Who do you serve? What do you offer?
Sure. Haven House is a homeless shelter for families with children. This is our 30th anniversary. We've been in business since 1983. We are the only shelter that provides shelter to families, no matter what their makeup is, what their composition is. We can take single fathers in, two-parent families, and male children of any age, where other shelters have restrictions against those family compositions.
Linda, you've been through Haven House. Tell us a little bit about your experience. What was your situation when you first got there?
Our situation was one of those where other shelters turned us away because it was myself and my 25-year-old severely impaired son. And because he was 25, he was not accepted into traditional shelters. simply because of his age.
So you really had no options besides Haven House. That sounds like it makes Haven House unique.
Very.
So how does that play out? Do you serve an awful lot of older children then?
We do. We have a fair amount of families that have teenagers in them, and lots of them have the male children, and there's a big change in our in how our families are made up. We do have a lot of two-parent families. We want to be able to keep them together, but there's a lot more single fathers out there than what there used to be, and so they need to be able to have a place to go to.
What's behind that? More single fathers.
I think that moms are taking equal opportunity to another level and saying, you take care of the kids, I'm going to go do something else. You have the children.
Mm.
So dads are having custody much more often of the children.
What about the need for your services over the past 5 years, Angie? Have you seen an increase, a decrease? Have they stayed the same?
Family in Ingham County, family homelessness has inched up a little bit each year over the last 5 years. And a lot of that has to do with the economics and jobs and what's going on in our economy, and some laws that were changed in our government with cash assistance through Department of Human Services. So I think that with families with singles, there's a lot that we can do, but with families, small bumps in the road can really derail your whole family and throw you into homelessness very quickly.
Has your funding been able to keep up with the increased demand?
We have been able to stay constant. This last year that we just ended in September was a little lower than other years. As we see the economy growing, a lot of people think that there's a lot more job opportunities out there for our families. And although there are a lot more job openings, the competition is still extremely high. And so it's still difficult for them to get into employment. Mm.
Linda, how are things today for you?
Things today for us are fine. We were able to, through Haven House, we're able to go into a partnership that Haven House had with Deer Path Complex when they were refurbishing all their units.
Mm-hmm.
They had to give up 10 units to a community organization that would have special population, and homeless people are a special population. So we were able to get in there. It is a income-based unit. So we have been there for over a year now. We are making do. We are doing better than making do. We have been able to reform our lives and move on.
How's your son?
My son is still hanging in there. He has good days and bad days, but he has bounced back. The whole experience at Haven House was not real good for him. He didn't understand what had happened, why all of a sudden everything we had was gone,
mm-hmm.
and where he was, he just...
Yeah, he couldn't process it.
No, he couldn't process it, but he has come back up and is doing very well. Thank you.
Angie, where does Haven House's funding come from?
About half of our funding comes from grants, either through government grants and private grants, and also through the other half is through fundraising through our own efforts.
What did you learn about being homeless? Was that the first time you were homeless when you went to Haven House?
Yes, it was.
Talk to us about what you learned through that experience.
That I don't ever want to be homeless again.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. It's very scary.
Certainly.
It's very hard for people, I think, and once you've reached the point of homelessness, everything else seems to just fall apart. You don't seem to be in control anymore.
How did people respond to you when you told them that you were homeless?
I think a lot I just got looks of, what do you mean you're homeless? Where's your house?
You can't be homeless.
Homeless. Yeah. I mean, and I don't think I fit the typical family going into Haven House with the fact that I was 59 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I had a 25-year-old handicapped son that I took care of. But it was through the staff at Haven House that helped me realize that it wasn't really anything that I did wrong that put us into that situation, and they helped me get my confidence back.
Mm-hmm.
And We went out looking for housing every day. And then when we found the place through Deer Path, and I had a mentor for a year that came every month to visit with Chris and I from Haven House and to just make sure that everything was going well. Did we need any connections to any other community services, anything they could do? And they really, really helped to get us back to where we feel we belong.
You stay with former residents then for a while after they leave. Tell us about that, Angie, and what you provide.
Statistically, families will lose their housing in the first 3 months after moving into housing, and we want to put a stop to that. We want them to stay in housing. So we have a Partners in Progress program where we have a case manager that goes out to their home and meets with them as much as needed for at least 6 months. But on average, our families are staying about 8.5 months with that program. And they're setting goals and they're doing budget, and they can be the landlord liaison if there's any issues from the landlord's end or from the tenant's end. They can assist with that. And by us being able to be there for the first 3 months, which is really difficult, get them through the next 3 months where they're stabilizing, they can make it the rest of the 6 months so they're stably housed for a year, which is everybody's goal.
Is finding affordable housing a particular issue in this in the Lansing area?
It's very difficult. And what we call affordable and what you and I would call affordable is very different. Most of our families leave the shelter and they have found affordable housing. What that means is they have enough money to pay for it. So most people pay 90 to 99% of their income towards rent.
Do you have to turn people away? Are you full often enough that you have to turn people away?
We're full every day. We turn away between 1,500 and 2,000 people a year just because we don't have the space. We've implemented some rapid rehousing where we're trying to raise funds to assist people with first month's rent and security deposit so they can move out faster, and we can double the number of people we help if we can cut the time that they're there in half, but still continue with that case management when they're in home.
And where in East Lansing are you?
We are at 121 White Hills Drive in East Lansing. We're right next to the East Lansing Post Office. You have to pull into their driveway to get into ours.
Did you feel the effects of the federal government shutdown, the partial shutdown?
Not as of yet. So far it was so good. The city funding that we have received that they get through HUD, they were able to cover those grant costs that we've had up until now. So hopefully there's not too much of a delay and there won't be one later.
Linda, do you feel like you're vulnerable for becoming homeless again?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. Because we did find the reduced housing, the income-based. Had we not been able to find that, yes, we would have gone out and we would have been paying all of the $475 a month that we had coming in would have all been going out for housing.
Okay. We're talking with Angie Mayu, Executive Director of Haven House in East Lansing, and a former client, Linda Bennett. Angie, do you accept volunteers at Haven House?
We do. We couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. We have a small staff, and we depend on volunteers to make dinner every night for us. We have volunteers that come in and help us answer the phones. It gets a little hairy in the morning when everyone's calling for shelter, and the residents there need a lot of stuff getting ready in the morning. And
the people you turn away, where do they typically go?
It depends on where they're at in their situation. A lot of times they're able to still lean on their support system of family and friends. Sometimes they may go to another shelter and have to split their family up while they're in those shelters because their family can't go into those together.
Mm-hmm.
And other times there's some special programs in the county that can assist them and put them in a motel, but that's usually for only a week. And we prioritize those families and they get in first.
Linda, I'm curious what kind of relationships you formed with the other residents while you were at Haven House. Did you form meaningful relationships with people there, or does that not happen?
I would have to say no. Everybody is in such high stress.
Okay.
When they're there, and you are confined to very small spaces, and it's very difficult for anybody to keep their business private. There's a lot of drama going up and down the hallways. And in my situation with my son, he is extreme special needs, and my devotion was to him.
It sounds like a challenging environment to keep everybody productive and healthy and not getting derailed, Angie. Is that accurate way to put
accurate.
It?
A lot of people do make long-time relationships through there, though.
Oh, okay. I mean, I assumed that must happen, friendships.
Yes, yeah. They do. And a lot of times, as our case manager goes out and meets with a family, we'll get updates about other families that they're still in contact with. So it does happen. She was in a special situation, and it was a good learning experience for the families that were there to be around someone who was severely disabled and have some, they had some exposure to something that they haven't before, and so hopefully they learned and grew from that too, which some of them I believe did.
Yeah, I get that. How do people access your services at Haven House here, Angie? How do they get in touch with you?
There's lots of different ways. One is they can just call our office at 337-2731 and ask for assistance through there. They can also go through 211 and they'll do an assessment with them and be sent to another agency who will do a full housing assessment and then refer them to us if needed. But families can call us anytime.
Well, we commend you for the great work you do. Angela Mayu is the Executive Director of Haven House East Lansing. Linda Bennett is a former consumer of services there. Thanks to both of you for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and Current State knows there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just need to learn about them. Please help us out and send us an email about these great nonprofits in the area to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Our election 2013 coverage continues today with a look at the campaign for Lansing City Council in the 2nd Ward. Incumbent Tina Houghton is challenged by newcomer Charles Hoffmeyer in the 2nd. Tina Houghton works as a liaison between MSU students and local agencies. She chairs the council's General Services Committee, along with serving on the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, and she is running for re-election. Charles Hoffmeyer is an information security specialist with the Michigan State Police. He hopes to replace Tina Houghton on the council. We invited Mr. Hoffmeyer to appear with Tina Houghton here on Current State. He declined to appear. However, he did supply some answers to questions that we sent him via email, so we welcome Tina Houghton to Current State. Nice to see you. Give us a little geographical breakdown of where the 2nd Ward is, just so we know where we're talking about.
Roughly, it's from Willoughby through Aurelius to Monhope, down Greenlawn, South Washington, back down to Willoughby.
Okay, very good. Pretty big area.
It is a pretty big area.
Yeah. If you're elected, Tina, what single challenge facing the city would you most like to help solve?
Now, when you say the city, do you mean the city in whole, or are you
Let's talk about the 2nd Ward.
Okay, great. Yeah. I think one of the biggest issues, if not the most significant this time, is the corridors, Pennsylvania and Cedar Street. Improving those areas, the look, the feel, making sure that vacant buildings are now not vacant, and making sure the neighborhoods are safe.
Okay. And what about the larger city? I'm curious if your perspective changes here with regard to the ward and the larger.
Well, first and foremost, the safety of the citizens of Lansing is the most important throughout the city. As far as there's a lot of work that's being done downtown Michigan Avenue, West Side, Rio Town. There's a lot of niches within the city, and I think those continue to grow. And being able to bring people into the city as homeowners or as renters within the boundaries of the city proper would be great. The jobs that keep coming into the city, and as we prosper that way, we will make our cities better.
Now, you mentioned the importance of public safety, which virtually all of the candidates have mentioned, and virtually all of the candidates, yourself included, have talked up the importance of expanding neighborhood watch initiatives. Is it a concern that these kinds of initiatives simply won't be enough to compensate for future cuts to public safety in Lansing?
Well, let's hope there's not going to be future cuts to public safety. I'm hoping after the 4 years that I've been on council that maybe in the first time next year, if I'm reelected, that there won't be a deficit. That would be really helpful. But as far as the Neighborhood Watch, having citizens be empowered to take their neighborhoods back is the most important thing in Lansing. I think it's the most important of any city.
How do you do that?
How do you do that? You talk with your citizens, you gather your citizens, you provide resources, partnerships with LPD, and our new now chief, Mike Yankowski, has been a great partnership in having neighborhood watches and having police officers, team patrols coming to those neighborhood watches and not only talking about the crime in their neighborhood, but how to prevent it. Good tips, good strategies, having people being able to come together around a certain issue on their block, or maybe it's even better or bigger than that, and it's around a neighborhood that might encompass three or four streets. But having that citizen activism is crucial in this area.
Now, neighborhood watches have been around for years. How do you get more people involved? I mean, is it an issue of getting just a greater number of people participating?
Well, I think one is it's hard for people to get involved, especially if there's already a crime being that there's already a crime issue in their neighborhood. They may not want to be involved. Maybe they're scared. Maybe they figure, oh, it's not my problem. But being able to talk through that and finding an avenue, whether it's putting flyers out, maybe it's talking door to door with them, maybe it's online. There's a few tools that I've come across that people seem to want to engage online more. And I don't think it's necessarily that they don't want to do things face-to-face. I think it's a time constraint for them. Maybe their schedules, maybe somebody works nights versus they work days.
Mm-hmm.
And those are perfect opportunities for people to be able to watch. In my own neighborhood, I'm a neighborhood watch coordinator, and there's neighbors that work nights that are home during the day. And so they're looking out for us when our daytime jobs are taking us away from our neighborhoods. So those are really crucial partnerships to talk about within the neighborhood.
With regard to revenue shortages, Tina Houghton, your opponent, Charles Hoffmeyer, suggests reevaluating city services in light of those shortages. He went into detail with us on recycling, for one, pointing out that the curbside program still isn't paying for itself in Lansing, although it was intended to. And he says the relative ease of driving here to MSU makes the $94 a year that Lansing residents pay arguably not worth it. What do you think about that service in particular, and maybe about city services in general?
That service in particular, I have been so happy that we now have our big recycling containers, the 96-gallon. Moving people to recycling versus having the curbside trash container, or even being able to reduce those at the curbside, it's convenient. I've also came out to MSU and recycled my recyclables when the little green containers weren't big enough for my family. I have a family of seven, and I actually had two little green containers, and a lot of times it still wasn't enough as I was educating myself, my husband, and my children on what can actually go into those. Now that with a single stream service that we have, a lot, if not 90% of what we consume in the household can go in that.
But I think his point is, as desirable as it may be, it still may not justify the cost. And I mean, with the ongoing budget shortages that the city has experienced, you have to look at things. Isn't it true? You have to look at things that you haven't necessarily had to look at in the past.
Definitely, that is true.
Yeah.
I am a firm believer of recycling and environmental sustainability, and I would not, I disagree with Charles at this point on that. I think it's not only convenience, it's also the right thing to do for the city. And the citizens, the more education they have, this is going to work in the benefit for not only our generation, but for future generations.
Okay. We did take some questions from Lansing residents for the candidates. Here is one of them involving the possibility of a casino in Lansing.
David Lambert, Potter Walsh Neighborhood. So what would you do in office to make sure that a casino is not built in the city of Lansing?
So David is not a big supporter of the idea of a casino in Lansing. What do you say to people who feel like David does?
Well, this is such a big issue, and I think it's a very contentious one. I'm going to disagree with Mr. Lambert in that I believe that a casino is something that we should offer in the city of Lansing. The tipping point for me was that the Lansing Promise, and that students would a majority of this. A return on investment money from this casino would actually fund a Lansing Promise and having Lansing students being able to go to college for free within the state of Michigan for at least 2 years. That was a huge component of why I was for the casino. Also, probably in the last, when we were dealing with the casino, I was in Battle Creek for an event, and I talked with a lot of people downtown Battle Creek, and I talked about how the casino and the casino that they have currently, and what was the downfall? Probably 10 different people, 10 different occurrences said that it's not downtown, that their fireside or fire keepers casino is not downtown. That was the bad point because it took everyone out of the city and put us into this farm country, and it was lost revenues for their downtown.
And you feel that the public safety, the public safety piece in terms of controlling any crime or anything like that, it can withstand a casino in downtown Lansing?
I absolutely do. Studies have shown that crime and casinos aren't necessarily coincide with one another. And I know our Lansing Police Department is one of the top police departments in the country, and I don't see a problem with this whatsoever. Of course, we would keep, you know, once this is in place, we're going to be a proactive approach and not just wait for crime to happen if it's ever going to happen, but definitely take a proactive approach in making sure that it doesn't happen.
Your opponent, Charles Hoffmeyer, says his top priority is code enforcement in the city. He says there's not enough people assigned to this, and he wants to empower neighborhood associations with the same authority as code enforcement officers to issue citations for violations of zoning ordinances. What do you make of that, and how is code enforcement in the second ward right now?
I think...
Does he have a point? Is it, I mean, he's clearly complaining about broken windows, unmowed lawns, decaying sidewalks, that kind of thing. Is that an issue in the second ward?
Well, your first one of the comments you made was about the sidewalks. I actually supported a millage increase for the sidewalks. As I'm out campaigning right now, my team members and myself, we've all tripped and almost fell on our sidewalks. So yes, do I want to increase money towards sidewalks? Yes, and have I done that? Yes. As far as code enforcement, I have to agree with them a little bit. We are short-staffed in that area. And I would love to increase code compliance officers. And I'm not sure that giving constituents the ability to just write citations, because I've also seen the other side of that, where neighbors don't necessarily get along. And when their grass is a half an inch longer than theirs, then that would be a citation. I can just see a lot of discomfort in between neighbors if that was able to happen.
How high on your list of concerns is code enforcement?
Well, code enforcement is part of quality of life, and quality of life is a big issue for me. I think if people like their quality of life, like their neighborhoods, feel safe, those are big reasons to stay or not to stay in Lansing. And having grass too tall is an issue. Part of what I do as a neighborhood coordinator is talk with people. First is, have you talked to your neighbors? A lot of people won't even talk to their neighbors. Maybe they don't know. Maybe there's they've had an accident and they are unable to mow their lawn. There could be many reasons why people aren't mowing the lawn besides being a nuisance to their neighbor. So first and foremost, have that communication, have that ability to talk with one another is a first and foremost concern of mine. And how do we facilitate those types of discussions. But with code compliance, I've talked and I have Scott Sanford on speed dial. I talk with him often about different concerns, and they do a pretty good job with what the staff they have.
He's code enforcement director?
Okay. He is. And now that this moved over to the fire department, I think that will allow some more insight and being able to get into maybe multi-dwellings for safety and landlord issues. But code compliance and quality of life issues are up in my top five priorities.
We're talking with incumbent Lansing City Council candidate Tina Houghton, who currently represents the 2nd Ward and wants to stay in that position. Speaking of staying in Lansing, which you alluded to just a second ago, let's listen to another comment from a Lansing resident.
My name is Jean Brisbow, and I live in the Home Street School neighborhood area. And my question is, my husband and I are both senior citizens, and we've lived in this area all our life, raised our children in the city of Lansing. Our question is, we are looking to move out of our current neighborhood, wondering why, as senior citizens, we should remain in the city of Lansing instead of going outside of the city looking for new housing.
What do you think, Tina?
That's a great question. First of all, thank you to the constituent that actually has lived and raised their children and their family within the city of Lansing. Why should you stay in Lansing? It's an up-and-coming city. We're trying to move it from good to great for walkable and bikeable communities. This is a perfect opportunity to stay active within the city as a senior citizen. There's many recreational activities for senior citizens. As far as neighborhoods, you're our staple in our neighborhood. You have so much rich experience and education within that neighborhood to be able to bring to the new families that are coming and hopefully staying within that neighborhood of yours. So what I would say to you is be active. There's board positions available if you'd like to take a more leadership role in those in your city. There's many things to offer here in Lansing, and I would hope that you stay.
Tina Houghton is the incumbent candidate for 2nd Ward on the Lansing City Council. She is being challenged by newcomer Charles Hoffmeyer. Thanks, Tina, for joining us, and we commend you for your service and your willingness to be involved.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Sure. Current state on 90.5 WKAR, nuclear fusion has long been seen as the holy grail in clean energy. Achieving nuclear fusion has also proven extremely elusive for generations of scientists. Last month, however, American scientists using the world's largest laser at the National Ignition Facility in Livermore, California, brought us one step closer to nuclear fusion becoming a viable source of clean energy. To help us understand nuclear fusion and just how important this milestone is, we welcome Wolfgang Bauer. He's a Michigan State University Distinguished Professor of Physics and has a dual appointment at the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Before we get to why this is such a noteworthy achievement, how about a little nuclear fusion for dummies? What is nuclear fusion?
Well, it all goes back to E is equal mc squared. You know, this Einstein formula that's T-shirt worthy.
Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so if you take light nuclei and you push them together, so the lightest ones are protons and neutrons, and you push them together, you actually get energy out of this process. So emerging two protons and two neutrons in what's called an alpha particle releases energy. Seems counterintuitive, right? Why would things that you just push together be lighter as a consequence and then release energy? And the reason why that is so is there's something called the strong nuclear force that provides binding between the nuclear particles and forms nuclei, the nuclei that are in the core of all the atoms that we're made out of.
And how does that compare to nuclear fission, what we use today?
Yes, so nuclear fission, now what I'm saying seems to be an exact contradiction of what I said just a minute ago. If you take heavy nuclei and you split them apart, you also gain energy. Because for the heaviest nuclei, that interaction is actually starting to get dominated by the Coulomb repulsion, because the protons are positively charged and they repel each other, as we all learned in high school.
There is a waste with nuclear fission that we've learned over the past half century or so. What about with nuclear fusion?
Well, theoretically, if you just make helium, the atom that has an alpha particle in its core and two electrons, that is not a radioactive waste. So the hope is that nuclear fusion lets us make clean energy without radioactive byproducts. It's not that easy because some of the neutrons that you produce also activate materials in the containment, and so it's not completely without byproduct. But in any case, the hope is limitless, clean nuclear energy. Mm. And it would be the same energy that powers our sun.
What other downsides may there be to fusion? Are there concerns about any other possible problems?
Well, I mean, there's always the possibility that a reactor that we would build in the future could explode, right? That can never be excluded, just like, you know, a coal-fired power plant could explode. But a nuclear fusion reactor would be a little worse. But we're not there yet.
Okay.
We're very far away from there.
Talk to us about what happened at the National Ignition Facility last month, then. Why was that a step forward?
Now, so let me first say what the National Ignition Facility really is. It's a collection of 192 of the most powerful laser beams in the world, and they're all shot simultaneously at a very, very small target, about half the size of a pinky finger. And what these lasers do when they come in from all sides is they compress this little capsule that contains the material that you want to fuse and heat it up. And then the hope is that in this compression and heating up, you make the conditions that overcome the repulsion between the protons and push them together.
They merge, yeah.
So that they can make nuclear fusion. So what the breakthrough is that, at least BBC News reported, is that the energy that was generated in these fusion events in these capsules that were compressed and heated exceeded the amount of energy that was absorbed by the material in the process of being compressed. Now, that sounds absolutely fantastic.
That's a greater efficiency? Can you look at it that way?
Yes, yes. Efficiency has something to do with it. We talk about a net energy ratio. All the energies that you release in a process have to be greater than what you put in.
Exactly.
Because otherwise you're just bankrupting yourself faster.
Right. Why has this been so difficult?
Yeah, so why is
They just difficult? Naturally repel each other. Yeah. Is that at the heart of this?
Well, we all played with magnets when we were little children. And magnets have a north pole and a south pole. And when you bring a north pole of one magnet close to the south pole of the other, you know, they attract and they snap together. But if you try to put a south pole to a south pole and you try to balance this magnet, it's almost impossible. And
yes.
it flips over right away. And these type of instabilities, they're also at the core of the troubles with nuclear fusion. And nuclear fusion, how it works, has been known since the 1930s. And the hope then was within 20 years we would have commercial nuclear fusion to give us limitless energy just like the sun produces. But as we have moved forward, that 20-year event horizon has never really changed. And so now we're still talking about, hey, 20 years in the future, we will have nuclear fusion energy. And there are two approaches. One is this National Ignition Facility in Livermore in California. The other is a confinement nuclear fusion inside a tokamak, which is an international effort that's right now being undertaken.
Inside a
tokamak is a large donut-shaped containment vessel that's magnetically confined. And that thing is being constructed right now in southern France, in Cadarache. And it's a sort of a $20 billion project. And it's scheduled to be completed maybe in 10 years from now.
We're talking with MSU Distinguished Professor Wolfgang Bauer about nuclear fusion and the road ahead and some rather promising developments with regard to nuclear fusion. Looking into the future, you've been at this a while. As you look into the future, do you have any idea how long before nuclear fusion is a realistic option as an energy source? Did it get a lot closer with this incident at the National Ignition Facility?
Well, I'm going to have to give you the same canonical 20-year number. To me, this is not that great of an advance. In August, the NIF team reported that they had generated 8,000 joules of energy. Now, that was almost comparable to what the energy was that was absorbed by the material, and now they have exceeded this. So
I see.
I don't
yes.
know what the most recent number is. It may be 10, 15, 20,000 joules. But to put this into perspective, what powers the laser is a total energy of 1.7 million joules. So, you know, 100 times more. And so until we reach those 1.7 million joules, we haven't really gained anything, because that's the real break even. The total energy that goes into producing all the laser energy has to be smaller than what comes out of the fusion. And we're very, very far away from this. But this is a very encouraging step on the way, because now for the first time, what they have found in their experiments actually agrees with their predictions from their computer codes. Mm. And this may seem like a trivial thing, but this is a decade-long effort by the computational teams and by the experimental teams to make sure that they really understand what goes on. Now that they understand, they can refine how they shoot the lasers and hopefully make better progress.
But the smart money is still on decades in the future.
Yes, I would definitely okay. say that.
Interestingly, nuclear fusion isn't the NIF's only business. It also conducts nuclear weapons research. What kind?
Yes, so we have what's called a stockpile. We have nuclear weapons that we might want to use in the future, but that they're just there as a deterrent. And the question is, how do we make sure that stockpile is safe and secure and not deteriorating away? In the past, what they have done in our weapons labs is do underground nuclear explosions. There's a test ban treaty that the United States signed, and so we have committed to not do this anymore. And so, and this is easily verifiable because it makes very, very, very small earthquake-like signatures that you can trace from other countries. Mm. So we know that nobody in the world does these underground tests anymore, including us. But in the absence of these tests, how do we make sure that our nuclear weapons are safe? And the only way to do this is to make giant computer codes that simulate how nuclear weapons degrade over time. And the only way that you can verify these computer codes is, again, through these little micro fusion explosions that NIF generates. Mm.
Wolfgang Bauer is a Michigan State University Distinguished Professor of Physics. Thanks for helping us understand nuclear fusion. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow here on Current State, we'll discuss HIV rates here in Ingham County. And Current State contributor Scott Southard explores Neil Gaiman's new novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. That and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Also, big thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.